very much. This I noticed, I saw the admission price, so this is going to be, this is going to be the $5 lecture, which, see, if this were the $12 lecture, $15 lecture, there'd be quotes from Gramsci and Engels. This is going to be, you know, out of my life and times. For $5, don't get too picky, okay? I know the kind of society we live in. Well, you know, when people speak about how they became what they are, they usually refer to a melange of influences and issues. You know, then there was this teacher who did this, and then there was someone who did that, and so forth. And the impression you get then is, I'll do the same, but I'd like us to keep something in mind, and that is, we're not just a mixture of these influences that impact on us. We aren't just passive receptors. What's often left out is the individual himself or herself. The receptor, the person who's speaking, is not at all passive. He or she would be an active synthesizer. You take these influences and things that impact on you, and you're not just an empty vessel who gets filled by that, but you actually work with that. You actually you bring additives of your own to these things. You bring your own mental labor power, your own emotive concern. You bring your own innate energy and insight to an issue and a cause. And this adds to our collective impact and our collective empowerment. So people sometimes say to me, they don't ask, they say, you're red diaper, right? You're red diaper. You know, I guess assuming you hold so fast to these views, you must have got them through your mother's milk, you know. And I say, well, no, I'm not. My consciousness and my activism was arrived at through a very circuitous process, mostly self-education, mostly undoing my miseducation. And, you know, quite often, the most important dialogue we have is with ourselves. So remember that. It's an interior dialogue, at least on a lot of occasions. At least it is for me. We do have evidence of people who have never had an interior dialogue. but they're all in power right now. I always thought that red diaper babies are very lucky. People who are red diaper babies, they it's like I felt they were benefits of a Head Start program. That is, that they got to these very vital things very early from their red parents, you know. I'll give you two examples of red diaper babies that I know. One of them is my son, Christian. And I'll tell him you applauded. Okay. Now, Christian, when he was 3 years old, he was coming on demonstrations with me. When he was 4, he was leafleting outside a supermarket with me. When he was 5, he was asking me to describe the Russian Revolution, which, for a 5-year-old who likes to play with guns, blah, 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 boom, boom, and his mother was sitting there saying, look, we're raising a Marine. I said, no, we're not. You just don't know boys. That's just their madness, but they outgrow it. I did the same thing, and I'm not a Marine. She had only a sister. She hadn't had much experience with boys, I think. But Christian, when he was 5, he wanted to know about the Russian Revolution. He said, tell me the story, Daddy. It's a great story to tell a gun-crazy kid, you know, action. It wasn't the guns as such. He liked action, not action. I said, well, you know, the Kronstadt sailors threw these guys in, off the boat and took over the fleet, and then the workers took over the factories, and there was the storming of the Winter Palace. And I went through this whole story about what the Russian Revolution was about, and he said, He said, what did they do to the Tsar? I said, well, they shot him. And he said, I wouldn't have shot him. I said, oh, what? What would you do? He said, I would have taken him and I would have chained him to one of the machines in the factory, and I would have forced him to work 14 hours a day the way he made his other workers work, and then he would have seen how much the ordinary people, the poor people, were suffering. And I thought, I got nothing to worry about with this kid. 5 years old, he's two steps ahead of me and one step ahead of Lenin, I think. The other red diaper baby I know, I think he's red diaper, is Ralph Nader. Maybe Ralph is pink diaper, I'm not quite sure. But last November, I was at the Eisenhower Foundation, Milton Eisenhower Foundation, to give a talk. It was a special seminar only for the board of trustees and other people, staff people on the Eisenhower Foundation, very select audience. And they were all given a copy of my book, Against Empire, to read, and that was to be the subject. And the chair of it, I was delighted, who I often admired him, it was Fred Harris. Remember Senator Fred Harris of Oklahoma, populist, was a wonderful guy. And he was chairing it, and Ralph Nader was to be the second speaker who would comment on my work. And now, Ralph and I have shared the podium a number of times, but this was the first time I had top billing. Not that that's important or anything. I would just mention it, you know. Silly ego things. Okay, so Ralph gets up after I talk, and he says, my father, Ralph Nader's talking, I says, my father, and I'm saying, hey, Ralph had a father. I just didn't think of him in those terms, but of course he had a father. He said, my father once said to me, Ralph, he said, capitalism doesn't fail because it always has socialism to bail it out. It's a very good insight. Namely, that means that, and you see it happening today, that the corporations have the bailouts of the collective wealth. They get, in fact, bailouts. They're called bailouts when they're edging toward bankruptcy. They get tax write-offs. They get direct subsidies. They get research and development subsidies. They get export subsidies. They get loan guarantees. I mean, you can go on. I don't even have the list. So they feed off the collectivity that they're constantly denouncing and saying collectivism, individual initiative. They got their hands in the public trough right up to their elbows and their necks. So now notice this, though. Ralph Nader went on to do things that were beyond what his father did. Otherwise, we would have heard about his father. My son at 5 was synthesizing, just this thing I was saying to you. He wasn't just a passive receptor to his daddy's story, but he was actually using his mind and coming to a conclusion about something. And we do the same thing, and that's a source of strength, that's a source of input and empowerment. Now, in my home was relatively politically impoverished. It was a blue-collar, Italian-American, working-class, low income, we were really poor. Money was a constant problem and a concern, which itself is a political lesson that one kind of learns in one's gut, really. Not in this society, not that much in your head. I mean, there were some good knockdown, drag out fights about Mussolini and the war. I remember those between my uncles and various people. And then there was the Depression and the poverty and the fear of that Depression. But generally, it was a rather provincial existence. I mean, there was a candy store and the handball court and the backyards and the street. I was a street kid. I lived in the streets. I learned to fight. There were a lot of fist fights. We used to beat the brains out of each other. We had gangs, but they weren't with switchblades or anything serious, usually. Although there's a story or two there I could tell, but I don't want to start. It's very much like what Herbert Gans called the urban villages. Gans did a study of actually was an Italian-American neighborhood, North End, Boston. And it's a very interesting theory, which is that in the midst of large cosmopolitan cities, you have these ethnic enclaves that are recreated sort of from the old world, and where people live in a very kind of clustered, you know, they all know each other, and who's that guy? We live on 118th Street. He's from 119th Street. What is he doing here? I mean, it was really, there would be times like that when things came, not really quiet. I mean, you could walk pretty much freely down the streets, unless you were a kid, because there was the other gang who remembered how you beat up their guy. They might want to beat you up. But, I'm sorry, Amanda. I think I'm knocking the heck out of your tape here. Show you how provincial I was. One year we moved to the Bronx. For just that 1 year, it was a temporary thing. Then we went back to East Harlem in New York. And all the kids, most of the kids in the class were Jewish. And here I was, what was it, 7, 8? I don't know how old I was. And I was struck by the strangeness and the foreignness of their names. You know, Rosenberg, Rosenblatt, Feingold. I mean, I said, what funny, strange name. Why didn't they have ordinary, regular American names like Puzzafiri, Bacigalupe, Mazziato, you know? Strangest names. Strange. But they were nice kids. They were nice kids, even though they had funny names. So when people ask me, well, how did you get from this neighborhood, and how did you get all the way up to Yale? I always say, I didn't get all the way up to Yale. I don't think it was an ascent. I got across to Yale, as I put it. I said, but I can sum it up in one word, and that's dogs. That is, my grandfather had a brown dog, and he named him Brownie. My uncle Nick got a white dog, big fluffy white dog. He named him Whitey. And we got a dog that had spots on it, and everybody called him Spotty. And that was the level of imagination in my family. And that's when I knew I had to get the hell out and go to school. The other explanation is, I didn't do it all on my own. How did you do this all on your own? I didn't. The other explanation is that it wasn't self-made. I mean, this society is full of mythologies about self-made man. He's a self-made man. Nobody's self-made. I could never have gotten close to getting any kind of education if there hadn't been, for generations, untold numbers of people, like a lot of the people in this room, whose names I don't even know, who fought for the principle of public education. You know, I was just three generations back from... not only a grade school education, but a public education at the college level. That was the only way I went to college. In fact, I couldn't even go to college at first. I'll get to that in a minute. But what we're saying here, and then even pressuring for the stipends and the fellowships at Yale, I couldn't have gone to Yale if I hadn't gotten support from them. So there's two things we've got to keep in mind here. First, in anybody's socialization process, there's a self-generated component to all accomplishment. There is a certain thing that the person is doing, synthesizing everything I said before, and putting some creative input into it. And there are other times when we so focus on the individual accomplishment that we overlook this collective effort and the social context that it takes place. All individual human endeavor is also a collective social endeavor. Take, for instance, skiing, which is a very individualized sport. They always focus on the skier and all that. That guy would never be skiing if there weren't generations of people who designed skis and then redesigned them, people who cleared that trail for him, people who designed clothing that was warm enough but light enough to wear, people who built and invented the ski chairs, is that what they call? Chairlifts, and all that. So every human endeavor is also has a collective and social endeavor. The reactionaries who control the government today want us to forget this, of course. So nothing we do is purely an amalgam of environmental influences, and conversely, nothing we do is purely our own achievement. Give credit to all those other people. When I was in high school, I began to get vaguely interested in politics, and I thought of myself as a Republican. I thought that would get a real laugh, but I guess it didn't. And that's because the only thing I read was the New York Daily News, which was a Republican right-wing rag, and the New York Journal American, which was a Republican rag. I was very afraid that communism was going to be taking over the whole world. The very first presidential, politics in our house, I guess, was electoral, as it is in most houses. People start giving it attention when an election's coming around. And the first presidential election I remember, where I really was reading and following it a bit, was the 1948 election between Harry Truman and Tom Dewey. And George Wallace, not George Wallace, Henry Wallace was running as a third party candidate on the Progressive Party label. Henry Wallace. Nobody in my family, my cousin Mickey Luciano voted for Henry Wallace, the only one. But the debate was about, it wasn't any debate, passing discussion. I remember one day my father just saying, it was just I and my mother sitting there. He said, Truman's finished. Truman, he's gotten kicked one side down the other. He's falling apart. He'll never get reelected. He's a loser. We might as well vote for Dewey, who's been governor of the state. If we got to make a change, Dewey isn't so bad. And my mother sort of nodding and all that. And then on election day, she came back from the polls and she took me aside and she said, Michael, she said, don't tell your daddy, but I voted for Truman. And I know what it was. You know, everybody predicted that Truman was going to lose, and hers was a compassion vote. My mother was very compassionate. She was afraid that maybe nobody in America would vote for Truman, and so she wanted to make sure that Truman got a vote, at least some votes. So a little while later, I saw my father. I said, Dad, who'd you vote for? And he said, hey, I said, I didn't know he was on the ballot. Pop, who'd you vote for? He said, the goddamn Republicans, you know, if they get in, it will have another depression. I voted for Truman. But don't tell your mother. So, I mean, you give a teenager this kind of weaponry? The very first chance I could, at dinner, when they were both sitting there, I told the both of them what they were doing. And they sort of embarrassed grins and all that sort of thing. So that was my first memory of an election. After high school, I didn't go to college. Instead, I worked for... The point I wanted to make there was, when Truman got reelected, I found myself, despite all my Republican reading, I found myself feeling very happy about that it wasn't Dewey. So that my inchoate class experience was stronger in me than the crap that I was filling my head with from the major media. Which, luckily, it's not that way anymore, because the media is now free and independent and objective. I didn't go to college after high school. I graduated a couple of years after that election, and my mother was dying. We had terrible medical expenses. We never heard of health insurance, and a lot of people today still haven't heard of health insurance. So I went to work. I don't want to go into all those interesting things about work and where and all that, but we don't have time. But let me just say that when I got into college, my first year, I remember reading. This is very strange that I remembered this. It so impacted on me. And it's very strange that I remembered it as I was jotting down these notes. I was sitting in the subway, and I seemed to think it was a literature or speech class, and there were these little readings. And the reading was a report, an article on beauticians and cosmetologists, I don't know if they were called that yet, or saleswomen and all that, were talking about the affronts that they had suffered with their upper income clientele. Talking about how these people think they're better than we are and how they will talk and say things to each other as if we're not even there and this, that. And treating us with disregard. These were people talking about the hidden injuries of class. And I remember reading this one little piece and getting a surge go through me, and like a weight was being lifted off my chest, because it touched, it spoke right to the class resentment that I felt, a deeply, deeply felt but inchoate feeling. The hidden injuries of class that are seldom expressed, where there are all sorts of subtle slights. And I remember one time being someplace out of East Harlem. It was somewhere off in Long Island, a suburban area, and we were visiting somebody, and there were all these kids from the thing. And I said to someone, "Hey, throw the ball." And the other kid said, "Throw the ball, hey, throw the ball." And they started imitating, "Throw the ball," to me. Of course, you know, I didn't start swinging, but I remember that, you know. My diction was even rougher than it is now, and here these other kids were making fun of me. They were middle-class kids, by the way. So, and then to actually read about an experience that others had in a college course, where the readings are usually dismal, and I can't tell you, that was a very interesting feeling. So, in college, I met students who were, in their own ways, just as provincial as I, but some of them had exposure to music and literature and politics, and I really began to enjoy that. I would go down to the gym on 23rd Street and box, because East Harlem, if you're going to walk the streets with your head up, you had to know how to fight. And here I was in college, and I would go down, and I never tried for the team, just sparring, you know. And then after that, I would meet my girlfriend, and we would go to the Irving Berlin modern dance thing, and I would do modern dance with her and other people. And I said, "Boy, these are two worlds. I'm not sure I fit in either of them. I don't quite know what's going on." But it was kind of interesting to see all these kind of new and different things, and to hear some of these kids talk about things, political experiences. So by then, I actively supported Adlai Stevenson in 1952. I was a liberal. I worked for the Liberal Party in New York, but I was still an anti-communist. The religion of that was still there. And one of the real crucibles in my life was the civil rights movement. It was one of the great political struggles that moved me, as it did so many other people. I would take nonviolent workshops with CORE, Congress on Racial Equality. And those were interesting experiences for me, to actually sit there at a table and someone whacks you across the face or smacks you or hits you with a rolled up newspaper. And I mean, a whole different way of reacting, because you get up swinging in East Harlem and you had to not do that and just sit and go like this. And so I can't wait till it's my turn, you know. And because we would, you know, change places and roles, and I would check out the whoever hit me the hardest got it back, you know. So you can take the kid out of Harlem, but you can't, whatever, et cetera. Now, what motivated me, I didn't know any African-Americans, or I knew a few African, I mean, some acquaintances. I had one African-American buddy in high school, and never, we lost track of each other, though. It wasn't that I had some personal connection. It was a question of justice. It was the injustice of this racism and this separatism and this stuff, the injustice of it. It just, I just know then and I know now that the thing I love most, more than beauty or love or happiness, is justice, to see justice in the world. And that was the feeling I had. In college, I guess a couple of closest friends of mine were Jewish guys who had pretty interesting political backgrounds, and one or two of them actually remained friends for many years later. I am on rare occasions I'm mistaken for Jewish. I think that's because I read books and I write books and I'm politically progressive and I have a New York accent. And I have a Mediterranean face of the sort, you know. And I'm short. Yeah, thanks a lot. You're Jewish, aren't you? Breakers. All right. One time I was at the Berkshire Forum giving a talk, and there was a room full of old lefties, mostly Jewish, and one of the guys came up to me afterwards, and he said, You're such a smart young fella. He says, "You're Jewish, aren't you? You're Jewish." And, you know, and I mean, his face was so beaming with ethnic pride, I almost lied about it. I didn't want to I don't want to hurt this old guy, I said. But then, the truth, since I speak only the truth, I said, well, Parenti, you know, it's an Italian name. He said, Italian? And his face, you know, befuddled, confused. And then the lights came on again, and he was beaming. He says, oh, of course, you're a Sephardic Jew. That's what Festinger called cognitive dissonance. I think it was Festinger, right? Danny, you would know. I mean, it's 40 years ago since I read Festinger. But cognitive dissonance is when there's a disparity between what you expect reality to be and what seems to be the evidence that's coming into you. So what you do is you create cognitions that will diminish that dissonance or disparity, that explain it away. And that's what... That was a perfect example of it, I thought. Very creative. Again, you see, people are creative in their perceptions. Sometimes too creative. Okay. I became and I remained a liberal academic right up until the Vietnam era. I was active. I mean, I by this time I was an activist. I had gone out on the Woolworths boycotts because they weren't hiring African-American workers and trying to get people turned away. I did support work for the UF. Now, the UFW came later. I already was a full-blown lefty by then. There was a number of things we did. Academia was a very stuffy place. I went into it with an idealized notion. I was so naive, I had a romanticized notion that academe's inhabitants were all principled and bright and dedicated to learning and concerned with problems of peace and justice and concerned with the university's role in the society. I mean, how naive can you get? That there was a community of scholars, a universe of discourse that we would do something about. And by the way, there are, and to this day, thank goodness, there are still some very good, there were then, and there still are, very good, intelligent, dedicated people in academia who carry on a very valiant and valuable struggle. I'm not painting one brush stroke on everybody. But you know, I found generally that intellectuals generally, I began to get a little disillusioned. I gradually discovered that they were often ill-informed, which is okay, because I'm ill-informed on any number of kinds of things. Everybody doesn't know everything about everything. But they would pretend to speak beyond their knowledge. And I would catch this sometimes. I remember doing an intensive reading of Freud, and I would bring things up or something would come up, and I would get these facile comments about Freud from people who were intellectuals who didn't know what they were talking about, I realized, but who had to have an opinion. Or Wilhelm Reich, remember reading Reich's stuff and people saying, people die in orgone box. I said, nobody ever died. But this is all said with a kind of a superior, knowing, dismissive air. But the need to feel that you had an in-the-know opinion about something when in fact you didn't know what the hell you were talking about. It's no sin to not know what the hell you're talking about if you don't talk about it, okay? So remember that. All the time I say, I really don't know about that. Could you fill me in, you know? Academic, and I'll tell you, one of the worst things in academia was the academic administrators. These were often the people who really had no regard for learning of any kind. Their primary dedication was to their careers, not to the students, not to the higher values, certainly not to any kind of democracy. The university was a hierarchical, top-down rule. There was a lot of talk about the academic community. There was a lot of talk about democratic values, but life there was really not all that much different from a corporation in some respects. It was very top-down. I got a story about corporations. But there's the Harvard MBA intern who joins a big multinational corporation, and he goes in to see the CEO, and he says, "Sir, that was a wonderful talk you gave us about we're all one big happy community here, and it's important that we communicate all the time. That was really good. But there was something you said. You talked about criticism from above and criticism from below. What exactly is the difference between criticism from above and criticism from below?" So the CEO says, "Kid, I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to demonstrate it. Get on that elevator, go all the way downstairs, and stand outside our office building." So the MBA does all that. The CEO goes into his office, opens his window, looks out, says, "Is that you there?" He says, "Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Here I am." So he starts spitting at him. "Pooey, pooey, 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 pooey." He says, "Sir, what are you doing? Please, sir, sir, sir. Pooey." He says, "That's criticism from above." He says, "Now, criticism from below, you spit at me." Well, oh, you like that one. Let me check that. Okay. Well, along with the civil rights movement and the anti-McCarthyism, I was right there at the height of McCarthyism, and we did fight all that stuff. Later on was the Vietnam War, and that became the other impact on me. One of the first acts I did in the Vietnam War, some of the earliest demonstrations, but I wrote a letter to Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who had been sort of a hero to me because he had led a lot of the civil rights stuff in the Senate and all that, and because he had issued a statement saying the people who were out on this demonstration were the tools of Hanoi, the puppets of Hanoi. And I was shocked. So I wrote him this rather long letter saying, you know, "As one who looks forward to the day when you occupy a still higher office, Mr. Vice President, I can't understand why you would say that. We people wanted peace, blah, blah." And he wrote me back an even longer letter. He was never short of words, Hubert Humphrey. And he was saying, "Well, the people on those demonstrations were no more communist than you or I, but they were the dupes of Hanoi. We have to be there. And it suddenly struck me as a shock. Well, he's not confused. He's not all mixed up. He really believes this stuff. He's really pursuing this thing. And that was a kind of an interesting insight. That is, I began to question the war. And then I began to question the leaders who produced this war. And then I began to question the system that produced these leaders. And that's when you cross the line and you say, what is this about? I demonstrated, I picketed, I blocked a draft board. Remember a draft board center in New Haven, Connecticut? And the police grabbed me and pulled me through this hallway. One cop holding me here, one cop here. The one holding me here had his club, and he said, "I'm going to kill you, you dirty communist bastard. I'm going to kill you." And the third cop was coming and hitting me in the stomach, you know, with his club. And I suddenly appreciated all that training at the boys' club and at the city college downtown. We used to have a medicine ball for boxing, you know, you slam it into your stomach, toughen up, toughen up. And so I would do that every time he hit me. And so it wasn't too bad. But threw us in the paddy wagon, and I said, "Wow, this is good to really firsthand experience democracy in action." Huh? I, with just three other people, organized the largest demonstration, New Haven, peace demonstration in New Haven, Connecticut, up to that point. We had William Sloan Coffin speak, to whom I dedicated my first book, by the way. Got Arthur Miller to speak. Somebody said, "We should get Arthur Miller. Got to get." I called Arthur Miller, the great playwright, Death of a Salesman, all, you know, much admired. And he said, "I don't know. I'm a playwright." I said, "No, you'll do wonderful." I suddenly was a Jewish mama. I was saying, "You'll do fine. Don't worry. No, but the people want you. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's my outdoors, you know. Don't worry. It won't rain. It'll be okay." And isn't it? He came and he spoke. He loved it. He had a great time, and people appreciated him being there. So that was the thing. I went on later on to Champaign-Urbana, and during the Kent State days, we had huge demonstrations. You know, people always think, I see all those documentaries on Berkeley or Madison, Wisconsin, or sometimes Columbia. There were schools all over the country where these things were happening. Even some of the same kinds of personalities of the student leaders or faculty leaders, protesters, whatever else. And the same kind of events, the police and this and that. And you couldn't predict it. You know, it was a really remarkable, exciting time. All sorts of people. In Urbana, the fraternity guys were having special teach-ins against the war. The jocks, some of them were. I remember Sandy Levinson saying to me, I went out and spoke at Ohio State. He said, well, you know, these things can happen in places like, where he made a very brilliant analysis of why these things happen in places like Michigan, Madison, Wisconsin, Berkeley. He said, it can't happen at Ohio State. This is, and I gave my talk. 4 days later, Ohio State blew open and people were out on the streets fighting. So it's a very interesting thing. You can't really predict. There's something about people where they synthesize and electrify and mobilize each other and begin to do all sorts of things that weren't expected. It was in Champaign-Urbana where my academic career pretty much ended because I got beaten up by the police we were blocking a driveway. Badly beaten. I was hit, bloodied, my whole head covered. The state troopers had clubs like this that were about that thick, and they were coming down. And one of them, they were up on the side, and one of them came right down to hit me right here on the top of the head, which would have killed me. But someone else, another trooper, hit me on the side here. That tilted my head, so his blow hit the corner of my head. And I heard this guy in the jail say, if I had gotten a good first clean lick on that guy, he'd be a dead man now. And then I heard a couple of other people standing there in civvy clothing saying, that's Parenti. Now the chancellor will want us to throw the book at him. Let's hit him with everything. Plus, when you're that badly beaten, they have to justify the beating by trumped up charges, mob action, felonious assault, blah, blah, blah. And the chancellor who wanted the book thrown at me was Jack Pelterson. When I moved out here to Berkeley, the chancellor at Cal here was Jack Pelterson. I said, am I having a recurrent nightmare? What is this about? No. So I was found guilty. I didn't get a jury trial. My lawyer, who was thought he was so smart, said, no, we'll go for a judge. I said, are you really sure, you know, 12 as opposed to one judge? I didn't know that much. I was just being radicalized, you see. He said, well, Morgan, that was the judge's name. The judge's name was Birch Morgan. Well, Morgan's a fascist, but he's fair. I said, how the hell does that work? But you see, then again, you're a lawyer. You learn to defer. You think these guys really know what they're talking about. No lawyer jokes. I won't start. But and Morgan was fair. He was fair on all procedural things. And then he just wrote an opinion that was the prosecution's case completely. They brought in state troopers who said that I had punched out this state trooper who was 6'2", and whole story. So I was sentenced to 2 years in prison. What saved me was I got probation. I was already out of the state and teaching at the University of Vermont. There was a big flap there, and I'm not going to go into all the war stories, but there was a constant struggle and a constant fight. And what the system does is they attack ad hominemly. They attack the protesters. So they make the protester the issue rather than the things we're protesting, which is often why I don't like to talk about myself. When I wrote Dirty Truths, a number of people say, I had a few autobiographical essays in there. And I said, we're not going to talk about the real Michael Parenti. I said, please, let's not. I mean, that's not as interesting. I think my idea is much more interesting. And those essays, by the way, were written because they had a political theme in them or moral in them. So to make it a long story of struggle, those were very hard, very lean years. It wasn't that easy, as radicalized and liberated as you become. It's not that easy to see colleagues, fellow graduate students you knew at Yale, now getting their sabbaticals at Oxford and their chairs at Cornell and here and there. and their big houses. And there, I was living in a little co-op with five other people so that I could pay child support. And like, it wasn't easy. They were very hard years, which I didn't put in the essay because I don't want to give our enemies the satisfaction, best, you know. The final revenge is to live well and as happily as we can in this insane world. So, to make that whole long story short, I've been kicked out of some of the best universities in America. And all those years I also went on doing support work and boycotting and more speaking and writing. That takes a lot of time and energy. It's the travel that really knocks it out of you, you know. And I remember that I was considered a wild man by some of my academic colleagues. He's a wild man. Stop that anarchist agitation there. But it wasn't that I was so wild, it was that they were so tame, I think. I was considered a radical. But it wasn't, I didn't feel I was so radical. I was coming to these things with all the innocence of a child almost. I said, wait a minute, you know, I think the Vietnam War is just this, and people would say, whoa, you know? I realized only in retrospect that I was becoming a Marxist without having read Marx. I would say things like, you know, I think a lot of liberals are evading the whole issue of class power. There's a class power, and that class power plays a role in foreign policy. You know, I mean, this is really an imperialistic kind of thing we're looking at. And people would say, that's Marx, whoa, that's Marx. Or I'd say, you know, I don't think the police are neutral. We always hear they're neutral, they support the law here and there. I don't think they're neutral at all. You know, you look at strikes, the police are always defending the factory against the factory worker. Why don't they favor the factory worker against the factory owners? They go, whoa, that's Marx, isn't it? That's Marx, isn't it? And I say, you know, I don't think racism is just an attitude that people learn. It's that, too. But I think it's a social force that's used and instigated and mobilized to divide people, to divide the working class. Oh, that's Marx, isn't it? That's Marx, you know? And so I started saying, this guy Marx must really be something. Whoa. Here I am knocking myself out to get an analysis, and they're giving him the credit all the time. And he's been dead for how long now? Well, as I say, I was considered a radical. I still am. But I don't think I'm so radical. It's that they're so conservative, all those other people, right? I mean, I still run into this. I still run into this with people on the left, we're talking about. I can take the stuff from the center and the right. It's when people who say they are on the left come up, you know, at the American Political Science Convention, which I got to go to in August because I'm getting an award. See, there are some good people in academia. So, but the other 95%, when you're walking around the hall and somebody, Parenti, still causing trouble? You know? Parenti, staying out of trouble, eh? You still causing trouble? And I'm going to say from now on, I hear that, I'm going to say, and you still kissing the ass of the ruling class? Randy, you still rabble-rousing, you old codger? You still rabble-rousing? What is that rabble-rousing? That's a ruling class term. You know? Mob incitement, rabble-rousing. Are you rabble? I don't think you're rabble. You're rabble. Are you feeling roused? Am I rousing you? I remember two times. One time, this is really great. Boy, you really can indulge yourself. What?
For $5.
They paid $5 to hear me talk about my problems. That's a great switch. Okay. Two times I'm going to tell you about. The first time I was at, I'm not going to say the people's name, University of Colorado, Boulder, I had just given this talk. A lot of us, we went down to the cafeteria, and behind there, there was, you know, like the big tables with the glass thing, and there was a guy working with the food, and I'm standing there with this colleague from that university, a progressive. He even, on certain times of the year, called himself a Marxist, depending on if he's trying for the deanship, he dropped that. But when he wasn't trying for the deanship, or he's talking to people like me, he would say he was a Marxist. He turns to the guy who's handing out the food, who's, I remember him as Latino. He says, "Watch out for this guy. Watch out for him. He's dangerous. Watch out for him. He'll take over everywhere. But he'll lead the rabble or whatever." You know, he's making these kind of. I said, "What the hell's the matter with you? What are you doing?" And he just started saying these crazy things. You know what the Latino guy behind the counter did? He waved away my money. He said, "Go ahead, take it." And I thought that was great. He saw me as a friend. About a year later, I was speaking in Los Angeles. I just spoke for FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. I did a fundraiser for them. 800 people, man, they must have made a mint on me. We've all gone to, what's that cafe? Is it a Bolshevik cafe in LA? What is it called? Or the Russian cafe. The Russian cafe. And we're there, and Gorky's maybe. Yeah, Gorky's, that's it. And he's ahead of me. This is one of the people in FAIR, a different person now. Totally different person. Well-known, writes criticisms about the media. And he turns to the young lady who is checking, you know, adding up our stuff and taking our money at the end of the line coming along. He says, "Watch out for this guy. He's dangerous. Watch out. He's a troublemaker. He stirs up all the people. Watch out for him. Watch out for this." You know what she did? She waived part of my bill. She said, forget the drinks. Forget the dessert thing. No, it's okay. I said, "Gee, I should be taking these assholes with me more often, you know?" And I've been wondering, I made a mistake. I wanted to go back and ask her, "Why did you do that?" Was it, maybe it might have just been that she just felt so embarrassed about the way that this guy was being so stupid toward me or something, and that was just a courtesy to me. Or maybe there was that inchoate class consciousness. I don't know. Well, what we do know is that there are left progressive, supposedly literate intellectuals who do not see how much the dominant paradigm has seeped into their political consciousness like so much dry rot. And by the way, it's a constant struggle for all of us. All of us. We live in a political culture that is quite insidious, quite resourceful. It has propaganda, but it's not called propaganda. It has images that are paraded constantly. It has duplicity. And so we have to consciously arm ourselves against it. And my books are all there for discounts, and that would be where you can arm yourself. But this is all infomercial. So, I was called a wild man, I was called extremist. Is it extremist? Let me ask you the question, answer it, you could all answer together. Is it extremist to want peace and social justice?
Yeah.
You see, I have to guard against it. Some of you have to learn the English language again. Okay, I'm going to say it again. Is it extremist to want peace and social justice? And I see why the funny guys said yes, because it has become, hasn't it? It's been treated like an extremist position to want peace and social justice. Is it extremist and radical and crazy and all that to want a clean, ecologically sound environment? No, it isn't. Be quiet, please. The extremists are already in power. These guys are not conservatives, they are reactionaries. They are consciously. We learned that a conservative was someone who resisted change and wanted to keep his privileges and interests intact. A reactionary is someone who wanted to unturn all these things and go back to a yet more retrograde position. These guys are reactionaries. want to bring us back to 1900. They want to destroy all the gains we made in the social net and human services. They want the conditions of labor. They want to destroy all that. They want everything for themselves. They are ruthless, ruthless reactionaries, and they play for real, you know, and for keeps. Now, also in my later life, after I became radicalized, anti-communism again took hold of me, but in a quite different way. First, I had become less hostile. I just didn't think the communist countries were the most evil, repressive things in the world. I saw that people had enough to eat in them. They had jobs, education, health care. Vietnam was a communist country, and what was it doing? It was fighting against an imperialist power, and there was a kind of democracy in the way people were mobilized, in the way opinions were discussed, and policy was developed through the cadres and the party. There was something to that. And the communist countries, I began to realize even more, were not the ones that were aiding and arming the death squads in Central America. They were not the ones supporting the rich landlords, the big corporations that raped the land, the corrupt generals. That was the CIA. That was the capitalist democracy that was doing all that. But I remained over the years very impressed by how many people, even on the intellectual left, are still rabidly anti-communism. How anti-communism, which they call anti-Stalinism, how anti-communism is really the centrality of their politics. It still is. I'm including those who rushed to sign a letter denouncing Cuba for throwing 25 people in jail after they were tried and undercover agents said they were taking money from the U.S. interest section and the U.S. ambassador, money from a nation and directives and coordinating their efforts with representatives of a nation that for 45 years has sworn to overthrow and destroy this government and the society they were building, a nation that had imposed blockades upon Cuba, a nation that had attacked Cuba, that spread dengue fever in Cuba with hundreds of people dying, a nation that has maligned Cuba at every possibility, a nation that refuses to give up this armed base in Guantanamo, that is now threatening and saying the Cubans, well, we think they've given biotech information to countries that have terrorist organizations in them. The Cuban medical and science profession does have a lot of wonderful biotech work that they've been doing, and they have shared it with other countries. To use that as a justification, you see, that setting them up. This is the nation that's about to attack and kill, and there are people there who are coordinating their efforts with that people. I've seen a lot of democracy movements ending up being nothing more than westernizing the country and making it safe for free market corporate capitalism. What I see among colleagues of mine, what I saw among colleagues of mine is a rush to sign that petition to denounce them, including an esteemed, iconicized linguist from MIT, including an American historian who wrote a popular people's history book about America, including another sociologist, Stanley Aronowitz, who was one of the people circulating the thing. Signing this petition, this is the best you can do. What about the 296 members of the Serbian Socialist Party who are in jail without a trial, without charges, right now? Not a word. They don't even know about that. What about the 7,000 that have been arrested in Serbia? I was there when it was happening. Just a few months ago, I arrived the day that the Prime Minister of Serbia, Djindjic, was assassinated. And people started getting arrested, including one person who had worked on my book. What about that? Can we have a petition for that? Well, they're not even thinking about it. They're being led around by the nose by the stuff on Cuba. And for their own credibility, for their own legitimacy, to demonstrate their sincere commitment to democracy, they're lining up and doing the work of George Bush and such. So the last thing you'd want to do is sign something like that and propagandize that and lend your name to that when that country is now being targeted for attack. Well, you can see the same by how many of them supported the bombing of Yugoslavia. I'm talking about people who shared the brief that went up to that bombing. I'm talking about people who have demonstrated against a war that was directed at a right-wing, rich, reactionary terrorist named Osama bin Laden, and a Taliban organization that was one of the most repressive in the world. They opposed that war. They were able to oppose that war, as they should, and that's to their credit, as we oppose it also. They opposed the war against a right-wing murderer and torturer, former CIA collaborator, Saddam Hussein. They opposed that war, didn't mind the stigma, but they couldn't oppose the war against Slobodan Milosevic, who was democratically elected by his people, who ran a government with a four-party coalition, where there was opposition all over Belgrade. You could see posters up against him and whatever else. I was there when he was still president of Yugoslavia. I was there in July of 99, not long after the bombings. And they supported that war because they bought into. These are people who say don't believe the media. They write books about how the media lies, and they swallowed every one of those lies. Why? Because Milosevic had a communist, i.e. Stalinist, genealogy. He had been a member of the Communist Party, of the Serbian Socialist Party, which had communist origins. In fact, he was way ahead of the Serbian Party, in my second visit, the one I just had. They were talking about how Milosevic was really much more advanced and into socialism. So the Serbian Socialist Party now has been purged and been taken over. And what has happened now with the Social Democrats? What has happened is that they no longer have communism to worry about, but it's still on their back. It's a lifelong habit, and they've still got to announce how communist. With elaborate casualness in the middle of a talk that has nothing to do with that, they'll make some allusion to Stalin or the totalitarianism of the Soviet Union or this or that or something like that. It was elaborately casually, just to flash their credentials, you know. There was something else I wanted to say about that, but I've forgotten. Oh, I'm having a senior moment. Share it with me. Well, it's lost. Okay. I really like what Dick Gregory said once in 1980-something. Dick Gregory, he got up, he said, why don't they blame something bad on the communists? He says, we got the civil rights movement going, and we hear people saying, oh, there's a communist behind that, communist. We got this peace movement, the nuclear freeze, and you hear people saying, oh, there's a communist behind that, you know. And we're organizing industrial unions. We say, oh, the communists behind doing that. Fighting segregation, all these other things. Communists are doing that. So Dick Gregory said, why don't they blame something bad on the communists, you know? In 1992, I'm going to wind it down here. In 1992, the Committees of Correspondence held a convention here in Berkeley, their founding convention. The purpose of the convention was to decide when to hold another convention. It really was. I couldn't believe it. I said, no, I'm not joining this organization. But it was very interesting because they were putting together a platform of what, you know, what the organization would stand for, and somebody got up to the microphone and said, you don't have anything in there about the rights of gays. And it was, we should have something about the rights of gays. And then a woman got up and she said, excuse me, it should be the rights of gays and lesbians. I said, oh, right, that's right, right. Then a third person, I think he was a guy, he got up, and transgender and transsexual was not a term yet in vogue. It came about a couple of years later. But what was it then that he had? Oh, bisexual. He said, it should be gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. And at this point, there's an old trade union lefty sitting behind me. He said it just loud enough for people around him to say, he said, people who are too tired to have sex when they get home from work. Ladies and gentlemen, that's who I speak for. The people who are too tired to have sex when they get home from work. Luckily, I don't have a taxing commute. I work at home, so I have a little bit of energy to fight for these people. But I'm saying it allegorically. It's the people, it's all of us who are too tired for the way our society and the good things that we want and our environment have been pulverized. The struggle is between those who are dedicated to maximizing economic inequality, those who are dedicated to making the world safe for inequality, and as opposed to those who are dedicated to minimizing inequalities when they can be. The struggle is between those who want to use the world's land, labor, technology, natural resources, and markets for a capital accumulation process that increasingly enriches the few, as opposed to those who want to use these things for collective betterment, for the well-being of the many. Well, does it make any difference what we do? It makes all the difference in the world. If we did nothing, the reactionaries would have already had us back to 1900 in their program to third worldize the United States. Unless we resist and keep resisting and build our numbers, they will grind us into the dust. Does it really matter what we think or say? They ignore it anyway. They don't care what we think. Oh, they care all the time. Oh, boy, do they pay attention. Oh, boy, are they watching. They're crafting every statement they make. They're crafting and manipulating and watching all the time. They're surveilling and doing all that. They know that they stand on our shoulders, and if we ever give a collective shrug, they will be off. Ultimately, if we can change the minds of masses of people, there will be no armies for the ruling elites, there'll be no taxes, there'll be no instruments of repression. So we've got to keep fighting. I said to you I wouldn't have any Gramsci quotes, but I'll give you one because you've been such a nice crowd. Gramsci said we must always have a pessimism of the mind, realize how tough and how bad things can be, but an optimism of the will. So let's have an optimism of the will, and thank you so much for your kind attention.